We're in the middle of corporate reporting season. If you follow the business pages, it's one day after the next of profit statements. Woolworths, Foster's and many others. Stephen Mayne is the founder of crikey.com.au. He's also a shareholder activist and an analyst of the business world. He joins me. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Those various profit statements, how have you assessed them?
Well, some of them coming out right now. Today is probably the second biggest day of the profit season, with many majors reporting. And the numbers we've seen so far this morning: Woolworths are powering on like never before. Profit up 25% to $1.63 billion. So, just a staggering performance from Woolworths, and I guess a good demonstration of their efficiency and the market power that they have, being the dominant grocery and supermarket player in Australia. Foster's, someone which sells a lot of product to Woolworths, on the other hand, has taken its $700 million plus write-off on its wine business, so the poor old Foster's profit has plunged by 88% to $111 million for the full financial year. We're seeing these record losses continue to tally up. The property company Valad, which I think has just sold Goldfields House down there at Circular Quay, they've taken a $250 million write-off on its European property business, so they've had a bottom-line loss of $248 million. We're also hearing from Toll Holdings today, which will be booking its $1.3 billion loss on disposing of its Virgin Blue stake. And after market close today, we'll get the Rio Tinto result, which should be about $6 billion for the half year. So the resources giant chugging along, making about $1 billion after tax each month. So the retailing giant is booming, the miners are booming, and everyone else is struggling a bit at the moment.
Well, you've touched on the Rio story there, and Wayne Swan is, of course, seems to have opened the way for Chinalco to take a stake.
Well, it's a funny way to interpret what the federal government is up to, because it's taken Wayne Swan 7 months to formally approve the Chinese government becoming the biggest shareholder in Rio Tinto. And in giving that approval on Sunday, just a few hours before the closing ceremony in Beijing, it was bizarre at a number of levels. Firstly, the Chinese government bought into Rio through the London-listed shares, because Rio Tinto is a dual-listed company with about a third of its shares on the Australian market and the clear majority of the shares on the UK market. So the Chinese government bought in through the UK, yet for some reason Wayne Swan felt that he could give permission for who could buy shares on the UK market, when I would have thought there was no need for any approval anyway. And then he's managed to extract from Chinalco an undertaking that if they want to go above 15% of Rio Tinto, they have to seek further approval from him. They won't put anyone on the Rio Tinto board until after they've gone ahead of 15%. So in other words, you're not allowed to sit on the board until we give us approval to buy more, give you approval to buy more shares and to sit on the board, which is a sort of a strange thing, given that Rio Tinto's only got two Australian-based directors out of 15, and it's a London-based company, and it's only 15% Australian-owned. So it seems to be all right for the Brits and everyone to dominate the Rio Tinto board, but if the Chinese want to put someone on there, Wayne Swan's going to have to formally give his approval before that can happen.
Well, isn't the issue, though, that China will end up controlling, especially if the BHP deal, the Rio BHP deal proceeds, China will end up being both the seller of the goods that it's purchasing?
Well, that's right. That they will be the biggest customer, and that they would also be the biggest shareholder. Now, at the moment, they are the biggest shareholder in Rio Tinto, but they have no exposure to BHP. If the BHP takeover did go through, and with the current shareholding, the Chinese government would finish up with a bit less than, I think, around about 5% of the combined business, and they wouldn't have a board seat. So I think that wouldn't be anywhere near a position of controlling it. But you are right that once you get to an issue of the biggest customer being on the board, then you have the biggest customer being able to see how the company's operating and potentially being able to dictate terms. Whereas I think the contrary argument is that the Chinese are simply saying, we want to do what the Japanese did during the 60s and 70s, where the Japanese took minority shareholdings in a whole range of Australian resource projects. They still, you know, the likes of Mitsubishi and Mitsui still own literally tens of billions of dollars in Australian coal, iron ore, the Northwest Shelf. And the Chinese are simply saying, well, we're a big customer too, and seeing as the Japanese were allowed to sort of have board seats on these joint venture operations and be large shareholders, we'd like to have the same treatment as them. So it's a very tricky situation
well,
for the
it
government
is, but
to juggle.
As a shareholder activist, Stephen, and a frequent attender at annual meetings, what is the principle that should be applied here? That the Chinese, because they're investors, really are entitled to a board seat? It's as simple as that?
Well, I think it is unusual to have a customer on the board of a company, but I think that if you really drill down to what the key issue here is, Deborah, I think it's that China is still a totalitarian state, nominally communist country, and does Australia really want its resources being influenced by a country which is not democratic, which is not free, which is doesn't necessarily believe in the free capitalism and the rule of law and all those things that that we expect in Western economies? So I think that at the end of the day, if you really drill down to it, that is the issue. Whereas
it's actually a moral issue.
I think it is a question of, and it's also, is it a two-way street? I mean, we can't go in and buy up Chinese companies to nearly the same degree that the Chinese government is expecting to be able to buy up and join boards of Australian companies. So in any two-way trading relationship, you expect things to the give and take. And I guess the bottom line is that China is still, it's not the free state. And if suddenly China did control our biggest resources company and there was some sort of blow up over Taiwan or something, then how would that situation play out? I mean, they are our biggest trading partner as well. So it's a pretty tricky situation. But I must admit, I found it strange that Wayne Swan was formally controlling who could buy shares on the London market. I found that very strange. And I would have thought, and I've argued for a long time, that the Australian government should tell Rio Tinto, listen, chaps, it's time you actually came down to Australia and had your headquarters here, because you've got more than $100 billion of assets here. You don't have any mines in the UK, but you do. You make most of your money here. Do us the honour of actually being headquartered here, and please, can you have more than 2 out of 15 Australian-based directors? And if you were headquartered here and had your primary stock exchange listing here, then you'd be more than 15% Australian-owned. So I think that's, if you're going to start telling the Chinese whether they can increase their shareholding and who they can have on the board, I would have thought that maybe telling the Rio Tinto to get a bit more Australian itself would be perhaps the way to go.
Well, that's a challenge to Wayne Swan. Now, in the meantime, the Japanese, who you mentioned in the context of investments in Australia earlier, are stalking around very carefully, and they've picked up dairy farmers.
Yeah, look, it's a very interesting situation. Japanese brewing giant Kirin, which picked up control of Lion Nathan, so the Tui's beer empire. They bought control of that in the mid to late 1990s, and their stake in Lion Nathan, they own 46% of Lion Nathan. That's worth $2.4 billion at the moment. And then Kirin is diversifying out of beer, and last year they paid $2.8 billion to buy National Foods, which is brands such as Berry and Yoplait yogurts and the King Island cheese stable, a very big dairy and juices group. And then yesterday they've done a deal to buy Dairy Farmers, the New South Wales-based cooperative, which controls brands such as Coon and Cracker Barrel, and they want to buy that off the farmers for $910 million to create Australia's biggest dairy group, controlled by a Japanese brewer, which is certainly an unusual situation. But it's quite a big price they're paying, and the expectation is that the 2,000 farmers will approve the deal, and it requires 75% of the farmers who vote to approve it, and we're going to see the creation of Australia's biggest dairy group, where the same company will control Tui's beer and Pura Milk and Big M and Berry and Yoplait and Coon and Cracker Barrel and a whole range of very strong Australian food brands.
They own the Blumen Cheese Board, and they own the beer that you drink while you, and the coffee that you eat, the whole darn shooting match. What is the purpose of this? What do you think they're up to? Do they plan to expand this investment now into the very profitable area of exporting dairy to Asia?
I think that's the long-term play here, that there is huge long-term growth in... it's not just wheat, soft commodities, coal and iron ore, but the whole urbanisation of Asia means that there's massive demand for dairy products out of Australia. So I think they take a long-term view. And also, the other interesting point here is that the supermarket duopoly in Australia, Coles and Woolies, is so powerful that I think that the milk players just felt that they didn't have enough strength, that there's three or four big milk players in Australia, and Woolies in particular have just come along and said, you know, we're going to set up our home brand and we're going to brand it Woolies. And you look at the Woolworths profit today, up, you know, up 25% to a record $1.62 billion. A lot of that has come from their select brand, where they just go to these big suppliers and say, you have to be with us. We're 40% of the market. We want to brand it our product, and we'll do a bulk deal with you. And the milk players just felt they were getting cleaned up by Coles and Woolies. And I think that that Kieran and dairy farmers and all of them agree that if they get together and become a giant themselves, then they can start dictating terms back to the likes of Woolies and say, well, actually, now we're the giant in the dairy game, and we'll tell you how to do things, and we don't want you taking our brands off us and selling all our product as Woolies brands. We actually want to be allowed to do our own brands in Woolworths supermarkets. So quite a big power play on that whole thing about supermarket power and big suppliers who try and deal with the supermarkets and often find themselves getting cleaned up.
What about the consumer's interest in this? Woolworths and Coles, for that matter, deliver in their own home brand a litre of milk for about $1.30, which is about half of what it costs if you buy it up at the corner shop. Will the consumer perhaps miss out on some of those bargain basement opportunities to buy because now there's two Goliaths banging into each other?
I think there is a risk that the consumer will suffer in this deal because when you pay $910 million for dairy farmers, it's a big price. And yes, there's a lot of synergies where they'll be able to, you know, save on staff and close a few branches and just get all the power that comes from putting the biggest player in Victoria and New South Wales together. But I think what you'll see happen is that the whole empire that Kieran will control will be a lot tougher with Coles and Woolies, and Coles and Woolies will simply say, well, we'll pass on higher prices to consumers. So I would make a prediction here, Deborah, that you may see higher milk prices in supermarkets as a result of this deal. And it is something that the ACCC will be looking at, I'd say, because we are a nation of concentrated corporate power, and this is going to create one big giant in the dairy space, which will have a lot of power, and I think which will take it on to Coles and Woolies, and the consumer will pay more.
You're listening to Stephen Mayne. He's the founder of crikey.com.au and a shareholder activist. Stephen, you've spoken there about a big deal involving farmers. The AWB, the Australian Wheat Board, is a farmer-controlled cooperative and a monopoly. What's happening there?
Well, there was a big shareholder meeting in Melbourne last week where a majority of the AWB board were proposing to kick the farmers off the board. So at the moment, in what was very much a John Anderson special when he was the Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the National Party, AWB was privatised and given the single desk, and it was a private monopoly listed on the stock exchange. And under its very controversial constitution, farmers were guaranteed 9 of the 12 board seats at AWB. Now, I think a lot of people agree that that this governance structure didn't particularly help when $300 million in bribes was slipped to Saddam Hussein's regime, and the board seemed to have no idea what was going on. So with a single desk pronounced dead in a vote that I think went 110-5 in the federal parliament, where the Libs and the Nats, the Libs and Labor got together and killed off the single desk, the AWB board is now saying, let's get with the program and give ourselves a normal governance structure with a normal board and not give the farmer suppliers complete control over the board. Now, they needed 75% support from the voting shareholders last week to get approval, and they fell agonisingly short. They got 74.7%, literally 50 votes short, the closest vote in Australian corporate history. And the board, controversially in some circles, extended the voting by 2 weeks. So we'll now have to wait until September the 3rd to find out whether the farmers have all been kicked off the AWB board. And behind the scenes, there's an awful lot of strong-arming going on as both sides desperately try and get the farmers who haven't voted to make a decision on whether to kill off farmer control at AWB.
Now, meanwhile, things are getting also very ticklish at Babcock and Brown.
Well, I think all the teetering companies are finding it tough at the moment. I mean, Centro, the property company, yesterday basically warned that they couldn't roll over their debt. And there are some people saying that Centro will be probably formally in the hands of its bankers within a few weeks, that yesterday's statement was pretty gloomy. And, of course, you've got Babcock and Brown, similarly, shares plummeting last week. And we're going to see a series of profits later in the week from the various Babcock and Brown satellites. But they've moved on, and the CEO, Phil Green, and the executive chairman and founder, Jim Babcock, have both resigned their executive positions. Allco, by the end of the week, is expected to announce a $1 billion loss for the year. ABC Learning at the moment is suspended as they prepare to do even more write-offs, and their share price has plunged to a low of 54 cents. And even Gunns, the Tasmanian tree lop, has been suspended for the last two or three days as they prepare to do, I think what some people are saying, looks like an emergency capital raising to raise $300 or $400 million to pay down their $1 billion debt and pay back the ANZ Bank. And their share price has plunged 30% in the last 2 weeks as well. So all these companies out there that have got too much debt really are right now going through this cathartic experience. And and whether it's Babcock, Allco, you know, Gunns, ABC Learning, Centro, they're all coming a cropper with difficult situations. And too much debt and pretty poorly governance, poor governance structures are a common theme amongst all of them, it seems.
There's been a note from Fiona who asks about dairy farmers. Will it still be Australian owned? Now, it can't be, can it?
No, dairy farmers will be Japanese owned. Kirin, the big Japanese brewer, will own 100% of dairy farmers. I mean, obviously, the product that they're going to be dealing with a lot of farmer suppliers. So when you buy, pure milk, it will still be Australian milk, but it will just be any profits that get made that aren't reinvested in the business will be shipped off back to Japan. So look, yeah, it's an issue. It's one of those ones where it could blow up a bit like Arnott's did in 1991-92, and it's a very sort of, Australia has a very poor record on foreign investment in that we don't own much of the farm anymore, and this is a sort of one where there's some iconic brands involved. So if a group of farmers or someone or Dick Smith actually chose to pick up the cudgels here and run a patriotic campaign, it's one that could take off given the brands that are involved.
Thanks very much for your time this morning, Stephen.
Thanks, Deborah.